Hello and welcome to Living Downstream. I'm Julie Lowe, the Environmental and Education Outreach Leader through United Communities AmeriCorps and one of the hosts of Living Downstream. Today, our topic is the magnificent world of the raptors, and I'm delighted to be speaking with Kit Lacey of the Cascades Raptor Center. Welcome, Kit, and can you tell us more about yourself?
Wow, thank you so much for the invitation. Yes, I'm happy to tell you more about myself. I am the bird curator at the Cascades Raptor Center. So what I basically do is I oversee the welfare and the training and the programming that all of the ambassadors here at our facility do. Also very, very involved in the professional bird training world. I am currently the president of the International Association of Avian Trainers and Educators. And just last month, actually, a few weeks ago, our facility hosted the annual conference right here in Eugene, Oregon. So just real busy keeping, best practices for training and husbandry and enrichment for birds around the world going strong.
That's fantastic. I have a friend out on the East Coast who said she was out there this last month, and she just was amazed at the work you're all doing. So let me tell you about our audience. We have a great range of people in our audience. We have new enthusiasts to the field, and we have experts, and we have the whole range in between. So let's start kind of at the beginning, just for our people who are new to thinking about this. Can you define for me a raptor?
Yeah, I'm happy to. So, raptor is a category that humans have created to describe a class or different groups of birds that hunt, but they hunt using their feet, not their beak.
Okay.
So, there's a lot of other predatory birds out there. You can think of like pelicans and herons and penguins. Those are all predatory birds, but they are not raptors because they are hunting using their beaks.
Okay.
So if you hunt using your beak, you're not a raptor. But if you are hunting using your feet, you are a raptor. So owls, falcons, hawks, kite, osprey, and many more are raptors because they're seizing that food using their strong feet.
Okay. So when you say hunt, you mean that's their weapon, is their feet.
Yes, their weapon is their feet.
Yes, and are they able to kill with their feet, or are they just catch with their feet, hold with their feet, or does it run the gamut?
It kind of runs the gamut. So there's a lot of adaptations that different raptors have for what they are hunting and how they go about it. So for example, great horned owls are opportunistic hunters. They're hunting a wide variety of food. And if you come along and you're of the appropriate size, a great horned owl might decide to give it a go, and their feet are very strong and they have crushing power with their feet. However, falcons, totally different kind of hunting. They are pursuit hunters, they're high speed hunters, and they're specializing in birds. And in order to catch birds, you have to have long, skinny toes. So they're okay. Grabbing with those long, skinny toes, but they don't quite have the power in those long, skinny toes. So what they're doing is they're grabbing with their feet, and then they come around and they have a special notch in their upper bill called a tomial tooth, and they use that to dislocate the cervical vertebrae of the birds that they're catching. So falcons are catching with their feet, but they're often using this notch in their upper bill to basically give the final blow to their prey item.
That's so cool. I had no idea. And then I do understand, if I'm correct, is a turkey vulture a raptor?
Okay. Yes, I always like to say vultures have an asterisk. Yes, many people, many researchers, many scientists consider vultures to be part of this group called raptors. Now, all of the vultures in the New World, so North and South America, where we have turkey vultures, black vultures, condors, king vultures, their feet are weak and they're only eating food that's already dead. So they kind of miss that important thing that I just told everybody that.
Right.
Raptors are killing using their feet. However, the old world vultures, so Africa, Asia, and Europe, They're a little different. Their feet are a little stronger, and they do sometimes actually make kills. But for the argument of are they a raptor, yeah, we put all the vultures in that raptor category as well.
Okay, great. And I know another way vultures kind of stand out is they have a really good sense of smell, right? Which most birds are not necessarily known for.
Right. It's actually just the turkey vulture.
Okay.
All the other vultures have rather limited sense of smell. But yes, the turkey vultures have huge, big, open nostrils. You can actually look at a turkey vulture's face and look right through their nostrils straight out the other side. They're really big. Yeah, they're really cool. And so that vulture sense of smell, you know, what they're actually smelling are these chemicals that are being released from cadavers. Okay. So when an animal dies, they just start releasing these different kind of chemicals. We can't necessarily smell them. So it's not the stinky thing that we're smelling. They're actually smelling for these other chemicals from a dead animal. And so, yeah, they're sensing that. So when you're seeing a turkey vulture circling in the sky, they're right. Basically up there sniffing the air. And when the scent that they're going for gets weaker, they turn and then circle back around to try to dial in exactly where that scent is coming from. And where turkey vultures overlap with other scavengers, the other scavengers actually watch the turkey vultures because the turkey vultures are going to find that cadaver before anybody else does.
All right. Now, I spent several years out east. I was stationed over there, and we had a ton of turkey vultures, and we had a bunch of black vultures too. And the farmers and the ranchers hated all the vultures because they said they attacked their newborn sheep and cattle and whatnot. Now, then I came to know that it's the black vultures doing that, but the turkey vultures were being blamed as well. Is this true?
So turkey vultures are so tentative. They're so nervous. They definitely do not make any kills. If anything is even slightly twitching, a turkey vulture is going to turn tail quite literally, probably throw up out of fear and fly away. They are very much neophobes as well. So definitely not the turkey vultures. And yes, I think this whole thing about the black vultures, I haven't ever actually seen it myself. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense that the black vultures are eating healthy, young livestock. But, I hope that folks listening here can really appreciate the incredible service that vultures do for us and our environment. Turkey vultures can eat an animal that has died of rabies and eliminate rabies from the environment completely. The vulture doesn't get rabies. Doesn't come out in their poop or anything. They eliminate it. Anthrax, botulism, all of these really terrible toxins that could be in our environment and really hurt us are eliminated when turkey vultures eat these dead animals. So they are really, really important.
That is so cool. Now, as a bird, I'm sorry, we're going down a rabbit hole with vultures, but as a bird, I suspect their body temperature is higher than mammals, for instance. Is that why they don't get the rabies? Because the rabies can't leave the body?
So, well, yes, you're correct. Birds in general have a much higher body temperature than mammals.
Okay.
So birds run on average at about 104 degrees Fahrenheit, just kind of normal. So they run real hot. The reason that turkey vultures can eliminate those toxins is because of their stomach acid. They have the most acidic stomach acid out there. It's down at like pH of 2 and below. So it's really their stomach acid that is killing those toxins.
Okay, this is really neat. This is great information. Thank you. Now, to go down another rabbit hole, I understand at one point, I don't know which president it was, way back in the day, one of the presidents wanted the turkey, the actual I guess, American turkey, the wild turkey, to be our national bird. And somebody thought that was kind of a disgraceful bird, or it didn't have it didn't look good for us to have a turkey as our national bird. And so they wanted the bald eagle. But other folks said the bald eagle is kind of just a big old scavenger as well. It may look good, but it's just a big old scavenger. Is there any truth to that?
All right. Yeah. So I believe it was actually Benjamin Franklin that suggested the wild turkey as the national bird. Yes, we do have the bald eagle as our national bird. And yes, bald eagles are notorious scavengers. They will take an easy meal wherever they can get it. And not only are they scavengers, but they're also bullies in the raptor world. If they see a red-tailed hawk or a peregrine falcon or an osprey catch something, they're not going to waste their time trying to catch their own food. They're just going to bully that other raptor until that other raptor lets go of whatever they've caught, so the bald eagle can eat it. So, yeah, bald eagles have maybe a few qualities that we don't think are top notch, but they are a successful predator. And, you know, people certainly have that connection to them as our national symbol.
I do. They're a very noble looking bird, and I just a treat every time I can get close to one, which is very rare. But I'm thrilled when I see one far away flying above. If I can identify that white head, I'm thrilled to have seen it. Now that we went down those rabbit holes, tell me what role do raptors in general play in the ecosystem? What is their job?
Yeah, well, we talked a little bit about that turkey vulture job.
Yeah.
Not very many other raptors have quite that same job, but, you know, the raptor's role in the ecosystem is to, you know, keep prey species at acceptable levels. If we didn't have raptors around, we'd be up to our kneecaps in mice and rats. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as top predators, they are eating a phenomenal number of things that we might not even are, you know, knowing these animals are, you know, in our environment because they're secretive or maybe they're out at night. So, yeah, raptors are, you know, keeping that really important balance in that prey and predator system. And then because they are top predators, they are often one of the first animals in an ecosystem that maybe suffers some trouble that we can observe when that ecosystem is off balance. If you think about, you know, the peregrine falcons, huge declines in the 1950s. And that was due to, you know, chemicals, DDT in particular, in our waterways. And, you know, that wasn't good for a lot of animals, but the peregrine falcons were the first that people could really see that impact on. So they are just really big indicators of ecosystem health.
So what they were doing is they were eating fish or something.
They were eating birds. They were eating water birds had that DDT in their system. So ducks and things like that. And then because they were eating so many ducks, and that's, you know, they were eating tons and tons of water birds, that chemical would bioaccumulate, you know, get more concentrated in their body systems. Okay. And then what it did is it severely weakened their eggshells. And so when a female peregrine would go to incubate the eggs, she would just crack them just from normal incubation.
They were just too thin.
Just too thin to support her body weight, which is not normal.
Right, right. Based on their role, are they considered a keystone species then?
No, keystone species have more of a role kind of up and down, just more of an indicator species rather than the definition of keystone.
Okay. And, you know, it's hard to ask these questions because I tend to generalize if it's a raptor, it does all these things. But, you know, as you pointed out, turkey vulture is very different from an owl, which is very different from, I'm sure, the other types. You know, you mentioned peregrine falcons, you mentioned hawks. Well, I don't know if we mentioned hawks yet, the ospreys. Tell me, when these animals hunt, are they, you know, I almost think of them as a wolf, you know, chasing deer, but we know that the wolf tend to pull down the sick deer. Do they kind of clean up the sick and the dying, or do they just take what they can get as what they can find?
Yeah. So I think any predator is definitely will take an individual if that opportunity presents itself that is not doing well. And this kind of brings me to a really serious situation is rodent poison or rodenticide. Oh. So mouse and rat poison. So, you know, when folks are poisoning mice and rats, they don't just die somewhere where no one sees them. They tend to be weak and stumbly and walking around out where they become the most easy target for
right.
owls and hawks and other raptors. And so because they're an easy target, they're taken. And we have another case of bioaccumulation where these raptors then also get poisoned by the rodent poison. And what that basically causes an animal to bleed internally until they die. So I think that's something that, you know, when people find out that so many of these poisons that they're using to try to control their rats and mice are actually having a lot of impact on predators out there because they are the easy target. And then you're basically just poisoning the predators as well.
Are raptors social? Do they communicate? Again, when I say raptors, I guess we can't generalize. Are they social? Do they communicate with each other? Do they hang out?
Yeah, I mean, so yes, they communicate with each other. But no, in general, most raptors are fairly solitary in their lifestyle. So there's a few examples. The Harris's hawks in the southwest of the U.S. will live in family groups and cooperatively hunt, but they're really the exception to the rule where raptors, it takes two adult raptors to provide enough food for offspring. So the male and the female, once, you know, they match up, they have their eggs and they're taking care of their young. They are together and they're both hunting, but they're not hunting together. So mm-hmm. It's this real kind of short-term cooperative situation where they, you know, they talk to each other, they communicate with each other. One goes out hunting, the other watches the kids and vice versa. Mm-hmm. Then they're both out hunting separately just to bring enough food in. But often then, once the chicks have fledged and are independent, those two adults are like, see you later. maybe I'll see you again next year. So, but certainly, you know, they are defending territory from other pairs of raptors of the same species or even other species. So, you know, they're communicating with each other, but definitely unlike wolves, they're not, you know, hunting in packs. They're not cooperatively hunting, again, mm-hmm. with a few exceptions out there.
Well, you mentioned territories. Well, I assume then they are not monogamous from year to year?
Well, it depends. They are monogamous to a good nesting site. And so oftentimes, especially for those migratory species, they'll go and overwinter somewhere else where the food is good. And then they'll come back to the site. And if the other partner is back from last year, they might do it again. Or if someone's better is there, they might do it with somebody else. You know, it really just depends. But it's not quite as a romantic, lifelong partnership. More of like, this is a really great neighborhood. This is where I want to raise my kids. And you keep coming back here too. So I'll raise kids here with you again.
Could the female mate with more than one male?
I don't know that that has been looked at. I mean, technically, absolutely, yes. That could happen. There's been a lot more research with that in songbirds, and I never really come across much information where they've looked at the DNA of the males and the females and the offspring to see who actually are the parents. Definitely with songbirds, though, it happens more often than scientists had expected to see it. Uh-huh. But I'm not certain that I've ever seen any studies about that in raptors.
But you say they will come back, hopefully, to the, or predictably, to the same territory and might defend that territory year after year.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. Did mention one, I forget, one type that does hunt cooperatively.
Yeah.
Can you tell me how that works and how do they do that?
Sure. The Harris's hawks, that's a species that's found in the southwest of the United States down through Central and into South America. I believe they are found as far south as Peru, but they're only found here in the U.S. and, you know, Arizona, New Mexico. And so these hawks are living in fairly challenging environments. They're living in deserts. So what will happen is the male and the female, and usually the two or maybe three young of their family from the previous year will go out and cooperatively hunt. So they have, it's usually the two adults, the male and a female, they kind of perch up on top of cacti and watch. And then the youngsters run along on the ground and they flush out the mice and the rabbits and the snakes that the ones that are perched up on top of the cacti are waiting and watching for. So it's a real active cooperative situation where they have flushers and hunters and things like that.
Well, that's fantastic. How do you suppose they teach them to do so? Do you think it's just instinctual?
I bet the youngsters practice with mom and dad and, you know, everybody's just got to get good at it.
That's really cool. That's really cool. I need to do that with my kids.
Yeah.
What are some common misconceptions people have about raptors besides the portrait vultures?
I think people, the misconceptions that people have about raptors is, I guess, maybe some of the things that we've talked about. You know, it's sad when people think that vultures are ugly or disgusting. So we try to do our best there. I think also some of the misconceptions that people have about how raptors are going to hunt their pets and carry them away is another one. So in general, raptors can carry about 1/3 of their body weight. And the biggest ambassador here on our site, Celilo, is a female bald eagle. She weighs about 10 pounds. Wow. So she could only physically carry a bird that size, can only carry just a little over 3 pounds of weight. So, you know, I think raptors tend not to be the ones that are, you know, running off with folks' pets. I think also another misconception is people don't realize that we're sharing the environment with them. Mm-hmm. We might not see the owls that are living in our neighborhoods. We might not recognize that the habitats that we have, you know, maybe we have a wetlands nearby and a red-shouldered hawk is nesting nearby. So I think becoming more aware that these are animals that are right here, you know, they might just be right in your backyard, like a western screech owl, is really important and something to consider, just that we are sharing this world with these really amazing predators.
Yeah, they're incredible. You mentioned the rat poison, those kind of things. What other kind of environmental factors are affecting these guys?
In addition to having 33 ambassadors here where people can visit, we also have a wildlife hospital for raptors. So when people in our community find an injured raptor, they give us a call and they bring that bird up to our hospital. And so I can tell you that one of the number one causes of issues here is that birds strike things. So one thing that we get a lot of is vehicle strikes. So raptors don't look both ways before they cross the street. So I think it's always just really important to realize that that might happen. And that, you know, the sooner that you can, you know, maybe pull off and secure that animal and get it to a wildlife hospital, the better chances they have of survival. Right now, we've had several birds come into our hospital because of window strikes. So both sharp-shinned hawks and Cooper's hawks are hunting songbirds, you know, in our backyards.
Right.
And birds don't see glass like we see it. And if it's reflective at all, like reflecting trees from your yard, it looks to a bird that it just something they can fly right through and get to the other side for the trees. So we have a lot of birds that are struck fly into windows. So, you know, trying to make your windows less of a hazard for not just the raptors, but the songbirds as well is something people can do. You know, another thing right now is that a lot of birds are looking for nesting cavities. So folks should check their chimneys of their houses and make sure that those chimneys have a chimney cap on them. Because the last thing you want to do is have to call someone to have someone try to come get an owl out of your fireplace and chimney who has fallen down because they thought it was a tree cavity and a great place to raise a family. So now is a really good time for folks to check and make sure that they have those chimney caps on. So no birds go in there and try to nest in those really dirty, sooty chimneys.
Here in Oregon, are we in the Roseburg area and Eugene area, are we headed toward nesting season soon? Or is that later in the summer?
Oh, we've already got birds that are on their nests. So great horned owls already have chicks hatched and are in the nests. Some places might already have bald eagles nesting. So not everybody does it at the same time. But we certainly do have species of raptors that are nesting already and might have young hatched out or soon to hatch out. So yeah, we are in it already. So
well, characterize the environment or the ecosystem or between, let's say, between Roseburg and Eugene. How is that for a raptor habitat? Like, what would they like? And does that meet what they need? Are they looking, let's talk about the raptors, like the hawk, I guess like the hawks, not the owls. So everybody but the owls. Are they looking for open expanses? Do they, how much room do they need?
Yeah, I mean, again, this is going to be so different. There's just so many different, there's hawks that live in forests.
Okay.
There's hawks that live in open farmland country. You know, there's the osprey who needs beautiful, clear waterways. It just really depends. So in every habitat, we have different species that specialize living there and specialize hunting there. So there's definitely a lot of really great habitat for different species, you know, depending on if it's a forest habitat or an open country habitat between Eugene and Roseburg, for sure. So that's kind of the great thing about raptors is that really just about any habitat you go into, you will find a couple different species of raptors that call that home.
Should people provide habitat for them? Is there any kind of like a nesting box? Or I have seen osprey perches, I guess, that people provide. Or is there any habitat people could or should provide?
Man-made. So yeah, there are a few species that will do well and use man-made nesting boxes or platforms like the osprey. Those are a little hard to get up because the osprey platform has to be the tallest thing around for the osprey to choose it. But in some of our open country habitats, barn owls and kestrels both take very well to man-made cavity. They're both cavity nesters and people can build those artificial cavities and put them up. And I think the, you know, like the most important thing that people can do is, you know, really just try to invest in their own backyard native habitat, habitat that has flowering plants and, you know, native plants that go to seed, because that will bring in a variety of different animals that raptors will then hunt. And, you know, I think decreasing our use of rodenticides and pesticides, you know, stop killing the insects, stop killing the rodents. And then I think that is what people can do if they really want to help. I wouldn't worry as much about providing nesting areas as much as just even in your own backyard, trying to provide, you know, some native plants and shrubs just to kind of balance out that little micro ecosystem that you have.
If people were to do that, should anyone be worried about being attacked by any type of raptor, be an owl? Should their small children ever be worried? Is this anything? This is a rumor I've heard that people worry about their child. Maybe if their child is wearing a sparkly bracelet or something. I've heard that before.
That's interesting. That's not anything I've ever heard before.
Okay.
Raptors don't go after sparkles. they, in general, as any kind of normal wild animal, they have very little desire to share personal space with humans. So there are, you know, there've been a couple reports, along some hiking trails, up by Salem, where there were some barred owls nesting. And when the babies first started coming out of the nest and jumping around in tree branches, the adults bonked a couple runners on the back of the head. I doubt it drew any blood. And I doubt, other than the moment of silent impact, that was probably mildly terrifying for a split second. Right. That there was much damage done anywhere. But, you know, there could be a raptor that, you know, doesn't want you out underneath their nest. But like I said, in general, raptors want really nothing to do with their human neighbors, and they'll just fly away.
Which of the raptors are most comfortable with humans? As far as being wild and living.
Yeah, so definitely, you know, red-tailed hawks, there are individuals that nest in New York City in Central Park. I mean, talk about a lot of people and a lot of traffic and a lot of noise. Great
but
horned owls. Yeah.
But a lot of rats.
And a lot of rats. I know great horned owls tend to be very, very tolerant of nesting in cities. Barred owls as well. They're just... I'm not too worried about it. We have plenty of barred owls that are nesting in and around Eugene. Cooper's hawks are another species that do pretty well around people. They love to get some snacks at our bird feeders that we've put in our backyard to attract those backyard birds. Mm-hmm. And western screech owls are another small species of owl that love to hunt the moths that are attracted to streetlights.
So that would be a nighttime species you might look for.
Yep, absolutely.
Well, that's so cool. Is there any species of raptor that has disproportionately large impact on the ecosystem around here? So one of the raptors plays an unusually large role.
I don't think there's anybody that plays, I'm trying to think, in an unusually large role. I think that they all kind of fit into their little niche in their ecosystems quite well. And so just in a balanced setting, you know, everything is pretty much in order. I can't think of any raptor just off the top of my head that other than it would be awful to lose any species, unique species, that it, you know, would take the ecosystem into a nosedive.
What about, are there any species, raptor species of concern that we're losing around here?
Oh, absolutely. The northern spotted owl.
Oh, of course.
I mean, that is a species that, you know, unfortunately, is so incredibly specialized in its habitat choice, in its food choice. It's a very slow reproducer that, you know, our impacts on the northern spotted owl is that we may not have northern spotted owls, you know, in our world for a whole lot longer. You know, they are incredibly endangered at this point. Another species that is definitely losing ground from habitat changes are burrowing owls. Burrowing owls used to be a species of owl that was found quite regularly in the Willamette Valley on the valley floor, but there are not very many sightings of that species here in the valley any longer. More in some of the less developed areas of, you know, eastern Oregon, they're not as, you know, impacted by habitat changes, but, you know, intensive farming and, you know, just so agricultural and, you know, urban suburban development has really had a huge impact on the burrowing owl here in the Willamette Valley.
And I assume that's a plains species, not a forest species on the
correct.
Plains.
Correct. Yep. Yep. Exactly. Yep. Kind of an open country.
How do they make their home?
Oh, yeah. Great question. So here in the West, we have fairly heavy soil. So here in the West, the burrowing owl tends to take over abandoned mammal burrows. So in, you know, eastern Oregon, they'll take over prairie dog colonies or take off a little corner of it. Or, you know, skunk, you know, tend to dig. They have stronger claws. And so they'll take over, you know, some kind of burrow that a mammal has already dug. Now, burrowing owls are also found in Florida. And in Florida, the soil is sandy enough that the burrowing owl is able to actually create their own burrows. Mm-hmm. But yeah, here in the West, it's taking over other mammal burrows.
So when you say they take it over, do they actually take it over or do they just find it abandoned?
Yeah, they find it abandoned. Yeah, they're not fighting anybody. They're not that big.
Yeah. Aren't they, 6 inches or something?
Yeah, 6 to 8 inches tall.
Tell me more about the spotted owl. You mentioned that they have a very specific and limited diet and habitat. Can you describe that for me? They don't just eat anything?
They don't just eat anything, no. So they only live in very old forests. So really big trees, really big stands of really big trees as well. So they have very large, and I don't have an exact number for you, but they have very large kind of territorial needs. And what they don't like to do is fly across an open section.
Oh, okay.
So like a road or a logging road or a fire break, because that is when they are most susceptible to being preyed upon themselves by species like great horned owls.
Yeah.
So they're very tentative about flying over those open areas. The trees that they nest in have to be incredibly tall. They have to be broken off kind of just in a particular way that creates an open cavity at the top where they'll raise their young. And they tend to only eat a particular species of flying squirrel, mostly.
Oh,
okay. So, yeah, they're just really particular. And in general, in good times of food and habitat, they only reproduce every other year. So they don't have offspring every year.
Well, why would we care if we lost a spotted owl? That's a question I always get. That, like, you know, we have other owls. Why would we care?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they're not the make it, break it of, you know, those ecosystems. But what they are is a fairly charismatic individual of an entire ecosystem type. So It's not just the spotted owls we'd be losing. We'd be losing an entire ecosystem that took thousands of years to develop. And I think that from my point of view, it would be a terrible future to leave our future generations that come after us like, oh, well, that ecosystem, these huge trees, these owls, all of the other animals that lived in this kind of ecosystem, they're gone.
Right.
And they certainly won't be back even if we tried to create it starting today in our own lifetimes, we'd never be able to recreate it. So yeah, the spotted owl is really just kind of a symbol for this entire really endangered type of environment that, you know, as Oregonians, we should be incredibly proud to live so close to.
Right. So you're saying it's not just spotted owl itself.
Yeah,
it's what exactly. It speaks for. It speaks that we're losing a whole world that we don't even necessarily know what's there. When that spotted owl goes, he's given us a message.
Yes.
That I'm telling you, everything else is going with me, basically.
Exactly.
In this world. All right. That makes sense to me. Right. Are there any, can you tell me any examples of successful conservation efforts with raptors that you've seen, a species that's been endangered or threatened or concerned, and we've somehow done a good job to bring them back?
Yeah, absolutely. We've got two really good examples of that. Peregrine falcons. I mean, we almost lost the peregrine falcon here in North America due to that use of DDT. You know, between legislative action, the falconry community across this country getting together and doing conservation breeding of peregrines and training these peregrines for release into the wild. The peregrine falcon is no longer listed as an endangered species. They've been removed because they have recovered and their populations are stable and self-sustaining. I also think a lot of people don't realize that at the same time, the bald eagle, who was eating fish out of the same waterways that the peregrine falcons were getting duck out of, had an incredible decline in this country. You know, we almost killed our national symbol.
Wow.
It's kind of incredible. I don't think people realize how desperate even the survival of the bald eagle was. Again, DDT was removed. People were cleaning up waterways, the EPA, the Clean Water Act, and bald eagles are now at, if not above, kind of historic population levels. They are definitely not threatened even any longer. But again, it was because a lot of action was taken and, you know, that entire species was saved.
And with both those species, you're talking about something we've done. You know, most species are lost, or a great number of species are lost due to just habitat loss. There's no place for them to live. But these two species you're mentioning were actually endangered by actual chemicals we put in the environment, like poisons.
Yes.
It wasn't just we took away their habitat. We literally poisoned their habitat.
Yes, exactly right.
Which makes it more scary, but it also, it seems to me, makes it almost easier to fix.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. I mean, that's coming back to the northern spotted owl, is that it's impossible to recreate that habitat.
Right. But it is possible to stop using chemicals.
Exactly.
So that's kind of good news. Tell me more about the Cascades Raptor Center.
Sure. So we have been in operation for over 30 years here in Eugene. We're located in South Eugene on the side of Spencer Butte. We have 33 ambassador animals that people can come up and see. They all live in large outdoor aviaries. So just a real beautiful wooded environment for folks to get outside and learn about raptors. We have a lot of our training staff are, you know, just, we have training staff here every day. So those trainers are out and about doing training sessions with our ambassador birds. You might be able to meet some of those birds outside of their aviaries with their trainer. Uh-huh. And just really get that close up look at some really amazing birds. And yeah, we're open Tuesday through Sunday from 10 to 4. I guess next week it'll be 10 to 5. So Sunday, 10 to 5, we've got the time. The clocks are changing, so we'll be open an hour longer. And then, of course, we have our raptor hospital, or our wildlife hospital here. So when people find, you know, injured or ill or orphaned raptors, they give us a call. We help them safely get that bird up to our hospital. And those birds, folks don't see those animals. Those birds are, you know, obviously don't really want to be here with us at all and are nervous. So our hospital staff gives them as much privacy, but all the best care. And our number one goal is releasing those birds into the wild. And let's see, last year we had nearly 500 hospital patients. Wow. In 2023.
And when you get them healed up, do you take them back to where they were found, I assume?
Yeah, in general, there's a few exceptions. If it was a dangerous place for them and they got hurt because they were in a bad place, we don't take them back. Right. But in general, yes, we'll take those individuals back because, again, that might be exactly where that raptor has a nest and a mate and young and all of those things. So we get them back to where they were found or close to it.
And how did your animal ambassadors become ambassadors?
Oh, they are ambassadors because they can do this really unusual job really well. You know, they have strangers walking by their homes every single day. They are choosing to have multiple interactions with the training team. So sharing personal space, learning some unusual skills, like voluntarily running into their travel crate. So, you know, it takes a really special bird to do this work. And they have different backgrounds. You know, many of the individuals were hatched in human care to become ambassadors. So conservation bred to do this work started on our team when they were very young. A couple, you know, a few others were wild hatched and illegally raised by well-intentioned but misguided members of the public. So don't raise wildlife, folks. But yeah, I mean, the one thing, again, that they all have in common is that they're really good at this job, you know, representing, you know, being ambassadors for their species. It takes a really special bird.
You said they've been trained, a few of them. Are birds smart? Can they be trained?
I mean, every bird on our team is trained to do a multitude of important behaviors so that they're active participants in their own care and their own work. I think it's a little bit of a loaded question. Are they smart? I mean, do they read books? No. Does a peregrine falcon know how to keep its eye on a moving target when it's flying at 240 miles an hour? Yes. Yeah. So there's different types of intelligence. So, right. Training with animals, every single animal can be trained. People train goldfish to play basketball. We're not training the raptors to play basketball, but we're training them with a whole bunch of skills in order for them to do their job. And that is kind of a prerequisite of their being on the individuals to be on our team, is that they are trained to do at least a certain set of basic behaviors when we ask them.
And when you're talking about your animal hospital, you had mentioned some birds have been raised by people, well-meaning people, the public. Tell me about the legalities of that.
Yes, it's illegal.
There we go. Done.
It's done. Yeah, it is illegal for members of the public to raise wildlife, whether it's birds or a bobcat or a fox or a raccoon or a squirrel. It is against state law. And then on top of it, it's against federal law if it's a bird. So
if it's a raptor or any bird.
Any bird.
Oh, I didn't
you
know
are
that.
Not allowed. You cannot raise a crow. That is that's against the Federal Migratory Bird Treaty Act.
Even any a wild bird. Turkey.
Yeah, even a wild turkey. So for any native bird species, it is illegal for people to raise them, but it's also illegal for them to provide medical care.
Oh, okay.
So if you find an injured animal and you want to help it, pull out your cell phone. Everybody's got a computer. Most everybody's got a computer that they carry around. You can Google wildlife rehabilitation and lists will come up for licensed wildlife rehabilitators in your area. And even before you scoop that animal up, give them a call, because not every animal that you think needs help actually needs help. We deal with a ton of kidnapped baby raptors. People want to help and they scoop it up and they bring it in. And we're like, why did you bring this in? And they say, they give us the reason. We thought, and we said, well, actually, now we're going to have to spend our time to get this baby raptor back to its parents. So, you know, any issue that you see, you know, just pull out your phone, call the nearest wildlife rehab. They will let you know, do you need to contain that animal and bring it in, or should you leave it alone, or what to do before you take any action? You can get the advice that you need. So yeah, as we move into baby season here, a lot of birds leave the nest before they can fly. So it doesn't mean that they need human intervention. They just need humans to back away, keep their pets away from the baby animals, and let the baby animals learn how to do what they need to do. So yeah, just give folks a call. And as you can imagine, if you were hurt, you know, badly, if you struck a vehicle, you wouldn't want to be cared for by someone who has no medical training. You'd probably want to go to the doctor that has medical training. So think about the same thing for those wild animals. There are people, who, you know, our team here, they're licensed. They have extensive training caring for the medical needs of raptors.
And speaking of getting struck by a vehicle, I understand that happens very often. It'd be surprising to people why birds, raptors are flying next to the road. But I understand that it could come from people throwing food out the window, you know, an apple core or something. And it's not that the bird is going for the apple core, but it's going for the mouse or the rodent that was attracted to the apple core. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's a little bit less about the apple core and more about kind of just some of the agricultural areas. So if you think about like the interstate, there in between the interstate north and southbound lanes, there's grass and cover. And then on the sides, on either side, there's grass and cover. And then sometimes the fields are all plowed up. And so where do the mouse, you know, the mice and the other animals go? They go to the grassy areas that are always existing along the roadway. So it certainly doesn't help when people throw out, you know, apple cores and or anything, but the rodents are going to probably be there. So it's just a matter of trying to keep your eyes open. You know, it's hard not to hit an animal that flies right into the side of your vehicle. But again, you can stop and try to get it some help if that is truly just an accident that happens. So
the bird is going for food, probably.
Yeah, it's going for a mouse that's sitting in that tall grass.
Okay. And let me tell you another thing I heard. If somebody finds a nest, let's say of owls, and for whatever reason, let's say this nest is in your house, in your barn. So let's say a barn owl. And yet they have a nest of eggs. And what if those eggs hatch and they see a person before they see their mom owl? Will they imprint on the person? And then,
No, they won't. Here in Oregon, we've got a really healthy population of barn owls. Thank goodness. Parts of the country are not so lucky. Barn owls they're cavity nesters. So old barns in particular have great nooks and crannies in those cavities. So those barn owls will hatch, you know, they're going to be up high. They're going to be 10 days old before they open their eyes. And it is not that they're going to look up and see a human and go, hi, mom. Right. They're going to know the individual that came in and chittered at them and fed them every day before they saw that human is their adult and is their parent and is what they will be. So no, there's no worry about what happens if you took that baby owl out of the nest and took it into your house and you fed it. and it only saw you, yes, it will imprint on the person. Again, that's illegal. But just seeing a human from afar in a barn, no worries at all.
Because I had heard a rehabber tell me once that if she raises a baby owl, like we're saying, with permission to raise it because she's licensed, and she allows that owl to imprint upon her. So she has to feed it blind, basically, so the baby doesn't see where the food's coming from. Because if that owl does imprint on her, it needs to be taken away.
Yeah, I mean, they're not an imprinted bird, you know, a mal-imprinted or a human-imprinted bird cannot be released into the wild. That is correct. Right. And yes, so at our hospital, when we get orphans in, we do our very best to get those orphans back to their wild parents. If not their wild parents, then we try to desperately to find a foster family for them. Because A, it's a lot of work to raise them. And you don't want to raise any animal in isolation. And that's what you'd have to do. And B, raptors are way better at teaching their babies how to be raptors than humans are. Way better.
All righty. Let me give you one more question. If someone does want to get involved in raptor conservation with your organization, or let's say with your organization or any other one, well, what are the first steps? How can we go about this?
Yeah, well, you know, visit our website. You can find out about what we do. There are volunteer opportunities to be had. You know, we have volunteers that help us in our wildlife hospital. So our kind of our in situ conservation effort there. We have volunteers that help us in with taking care of our ambassadors. So our ambassadors are helping us fund that hospital work that we do. And there's a lot of other organizations that, you know, we're partnering with that are out there working on conservation issues. So yeah, if you're interested, check out our website and see if anything there speaks to you.
That's fantastic, Kit. I want to thank you so much. This has been fantastic. I've learned so much, and I thought I knew a chunk, but I've learned so much.
Oh, I just wanted to say thank you so much for the invitation.
Let me remind our listeners, this has been an episode of Living Downstream, and I'm your host, Julie Lowe. I've been speaking with Kit Lacey of the Cascades Raptor Center. If you dropped in late or you missed any part of this interview or any interview in our series, you can find past episodes at umpquawatersheds.org. And thank you for listening.